Dr. Dan Siegel had an adult client that he'd been seeing since she was a child, and for the first time, she was able to recall a lifelong shame, a memory that was buried for over 20 years. Here, Dan shares the four-step method that he used to help her access this memory, and the powerful discovery that came next.
This is a person I've been seeing for a while. She's 30, and she... I've seen her for many years, actually. So I know her parents, and I had family sessions with them when she was young. And she went away and developed a career and all this kind of stuff. And when she came back recently to Los Angeles and we started working together again, it was something because I've seen her developmentally. So I saw all these things happen with two parents who were very strong-willed but not really focused on her. And in the course of them having all sorts of arguments, they're still together, but very tumultuous relationships, she always felt left out. And in the family work, they were a very, very challenging family to work with. Let me just put it that way. And you could tell she tried her best to assert her sense of well-being, but her parents were so not focused on her. Anyway, when she now comes for therapy as an adult, I have that actually observed data. So it's a good case to talk about this way, but it also happened last week. So she comes in and she, was a little late and she was apologizing. She spent more time in the 4 minutes that she was late apologizing for being late, that, 7-8 minutes of apology. So this was an opportunity to say, tell me what you're feeling about the apology. She goes, well, you deserve for me to come on time and I deserve for me to come on time and like this. And yes, she should be on time. We agreed. But then what happened in the session was I said, let's see what the feeling is beneath this energy you have about apologizing so much. And she had taken a cup of water. We have some water in the office and was drinking it. And when she put it down, it fell over and spilled a little bit. And she was like all over. You could see in her face terror. So I said, let's pause. Don't worry about the water, it's water. And let's just stay with the feelings you have. So in terms of you're saying, what do you do with shame? For me, the whole idea of therapy is based on, I wrote a book called The Mindful Therapist that kind of talks about this in depth, but the part we play, P-A-R-T. So first is my presence with her, to be open to whatever's arising in her. In this case, she's late, apologies, spilling the water. So that's what the session is about. And I'm present for her internal experience. The internal and the personal is what we're going to explore now in what's happening between us. So then she goes, well, what do you mean? I'm just didn't want to spill. I said, no, let's stay with the feelings because there might be some connection. You're being so agitated about the spilling and, what happened with being late. And let's just stay with that. So when there was this experience in the session of her being late and the apologies and the water spilling and her distress about that, it was really an opportunity to be in the part that a therapist can be in, which in the mindful therapist I discuss as an acronym of P is presence, A is attunement, R is resonance, and T is trust. And for me, when you ask about, well, what does psychotherapy do with shame? We begin with this fundamental interpersonal neurobiology view of the way a relationship will allow neuroplastic changes to happen through a state of trust that's created with the therapist's presence, attunement, and resonance that ultimately is going to lead to a more integrated brain. That's the overarching idea. So in this session, the presence inside of me was that I could sift my own mind, checking on sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts in me. And I could feel something was going on in her. So I asked her to pause and just to check in with her own sensations in her body. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes I'll do bilateral stimulation depending on either my hand moving left and right. Sometimes it's a person tapping depending on the nature of the relationship. But I find that's sometimes very helpful to it, especially for very intellectual people like this person is, to get them beneath thinking with words, thinking, and instead become present with their own internal experience. P beyond, beneath, and before words. That's very important. The A is an attunement of the therapist to the internal world of the other, but one is also inviting the presence, the openness and receptivity to what is, the attunement of the client herself. In this case, to focus attention on the internal world. And the resonating is where, for me, for my part, is literally allowing my state to be changed because of hers, and for her to be able to see, to recognize that there's a resonance where she is influencing me. I'm not becoming her. She doesn't have to fear she's obliterating me, but instead she can feel like there's an expansion, what you would call a increased state of complexity within the interpersonal relationship. And that's from an interpersonal neurobiology point of view, that's what we're trying to achieve with higher states of integration, is optimizing the self-organization of the system. And this system now is dyadic. So once there's a resonance with the attunement and the presence that's there, trust can be created. And in this case, she starts getting aware of some memories of her parents yelling at her when she was young, even before the years when I first saw them as a family. And she reflected on that experience. It was as if she was back in there. So it felt as if there were pure implicit memories that were now arising, that when an implicit memory hasn't been integrated by the hippocampus and woven into its explicit factual or autobiographical forms, when it's retrieved, it's in awareness. So this is not the same as unconscious memory, but its retrieval is not associated with it. What's called an ekphoric sensation. It doesn't feel like this is a memory. So she's feeling the disconnection from her parents. She's feeling, and she uses these words, I don't belong here. I'm not wanted. And then when she gets even deeper into it, she starts talking about how there's something wrong with her, that there's something fundamentally flawed in who she is. And as we sit with that feeling, it's extremely uncomfortable for her. I can feel it in me. You can tell by her body movement. She's like that. And she says, you know, this is what I always feel always. When I'm late, I feel you're going to reject me because I don't belong here with you. When I spill the water, I feel there's just another example of how defective I am. So it's not just, oh, I'm late, I'm sorry, and oh, I spilled some water, let's clean it up. It's a window into what she deeply feels. This is the shame cognition. And you could feel the heaviness in the physiology of the shame. So now your question is, what do you do to help liberate someone? So there are a couple of ways of going. The first step is to literally be present, attuned, and resonate, and be there with the person in their shame. This is my approach, which I find helpful. I found it helpful with Matthew, and I'm hoping, because she's in active therapy, I'm going to see her tomorrow, you know, that this is an active thing. But with patients I've worked with, this is the way I find it's very helpful. Be present, attune, and resonate. There's a feeling of trust. What arises often in someone who's never even known they have shame is they start to realize, I feel I'm defective, and I don't even want to tell you about that. Then what we do is two things. I give a kind of psychoeducational offering that can liberate a person from the heaviness of it. And I'll say something like, you know, you've just described this fight of your parents. You've described how you felt like they didn't want you to be there, which they actually didn't. I mean, she was actually picking up what they actually said in private sessions. There was a feeling like, I am not wanted. I'm not going to be really respected and attuned to, basically. So I said to her, you know, you've just described me that memory that came up, and now the feeling of shame that's associated with it. I said, what do you think about that? Let's talk about it. So then I'm condensing, obviously, a whole session. But then what she talks about is this feeling like there was nowhere to turn, and that feeling from when she was six has stayed with her till now, till she's 30. And so I said, okay, well, that can be how unresolved traumatic experiences get embedded in our brains. And do you know, why would there be a conclusion you're defective when your parents are just fighting with each other and they're distracted? And she goes, I have no idea. I said, well, let's stay with that and see what arises. So she stays with it, and she says, well, I just no good. And, you know, my boyfriend, I feel like he's going to think he's going to realize I'm no good, and I need to push him away, just like Matthew in the story was pushing away people who loved him. In fact, I do this all the time, she says. And I said, well, what do you think might be beneath the shame? She says, what do you mean beneath the shame? I said, see what comes up. And then she starts trembling, and this deep, deep fear comes up, this fear of being alone, and this fear that something bad is happening in that moment in the session. So we stay with the fear. And what comes up is this image of her mother's enraged face and this kind of disconnected father face. He was more kind of aloof and she was more very volatile. And I said to her at this moment, for you to be six and experiencing that may suggest you experienced it before, and maybe you don't explicitly remember it, but what do you think it was like for you as a kid who was a good person, not defective? I say this is now kind of a suggestion, but yet you feel completely convinced you are defective. So we hear that and respect that. But what do you think your options were at that moment when your parents were acting in such a emotionally confusing way? And she goes, I had to see them as good. And I said, and why did you have to see them as good? She goes, I don't know. And she gets really frightened. And so I say to her, you know, when a child is faced with not being attuned to with positive or negative expressions, and they feel like they don't belong, there's a choice point that isn't done consciously, but it's where shame is chosen, that there's something wrong with me rather than there's something wrong with, and then she goes, my parents. I go, yeah. She goes, why do you think kids do that? And I said, this is one developmental view of different views, but this is one view of the origins of shame. I said, why do you think you do it? And she's in a, you know, very deep state of reflection. And she goes, I can't see, and she says in the present tense, I can't see my parents as defective. And I said, yeah. I said, if a child, what's a child's number one need? She said, to be protected. I said, sure. So if you think your parents are defective, something wrong with them, they're inadequate, you're going to go insane. So I said, you chose shame over being insane. And I said, excellent choice. She like looks at me. I said, excellent choice. I said, now it's time for your software to be updated, because a part of you has been holding on to this shame, this state of shame, this state of mind, and it's been great. It kept you from being insane, and that's great because you are so far from insane. It's magnificent, but you know, you don't need to do that anymore. Now you can say, maybe there were, my parents were defective, and she gets this, her body kind of shifts, her shoulders go back, and she goes, oh my God. And I said, what? And she goes, you mean it may not be true? I said, it may not be true, and I know you believe it's true. Actually, it's not true. I said, I've known you since you're a pipsqueak, and you're an amazing human being. And now I'm doing, in many ways, the parenting she never had. And the presence of attunement and resonance and trust is a very direct way, because I actually feel this way about her, so I don't have to fake it, but you know, she's an amazing human being. I said, of course you were took on a belief you're defective to protect you from going insane. That's awesome. And now I don't know if you need that. Maybe you need it. Maybe you don't need it. She goes, well, I don't think I need it. I said, okay, well, then we'll work on it. So we'll see what happens tomorrow. But, you know, this is the experience of a developmental view.
As we saw with Dan's client, children can drive implicit memories deep beneath the surface, especially if the trade-off is holding on to feelings of safety and protection. To get some more insight on these ideas, here's Dr. Kelly McGonigal and Dr. Ron Siegel.
For most children, if they're in some way being rejected, neglected, spoken to harshly, in some way they're being injured, they have kind of two options if the person doing the injury is the primary caregiver. Either, oh my God, my primary caregiver, usually a parent, is deeply flawed and I'm out in the world without any kind of support, or there's something terribly wrong with me and I've been very bad. And we see over and over and over, and I used to work a lot with kids who had suffered from sexual and physical abuse. Over and over and over, the victims of sexual and physical abuse would pick the latter option because the thought of not having parents was just so scary, and for good reason. You know, I mean, you know, children can't survive without caregivers here, so that they would default to the idea that there was something terribly wrong with me. And this would happen, you know, even when the parental behavior was really, you know, quite outrageous by, you know, by anybody's estimation. And it's interesting even to think about this in normal development, even if there hasn't been abuse or neglect. You know, when we're little kids, we tend to think that, you know, parents or other adults are, you know, they're at godlike levels. They're, you know, they have powers that are, that so exceed our abilities in the world. And then as we age, we at a certain point may reach a point where we realize, oh gosh, I am now the age that my mother or father or some other caregiver was when X, Y, or Z happens. And we realize, oh gosh, I'm a lost and struggling human being trying to deal with many competing feelings and difficulties, and I have good days and bad days. And that caregiver was here. You know, that was, you know, they weren't some god. They were a lost and struggling human being. And just how maybe liberating, maybe disillusioning that can be, but how dangerous it is to think of our caregivers that way when we're young. And then how this gets carried forward into so many other relationships, you know, our assumption of badness or shame about something. So I just wanted to emphasize that point that Dan made, because I thought it has so much clinical relevance.
Yeah, that was exactly my main takeaway too. It really stood out to me because it seemed like both a very true observation that he was able to walk his client through, but also an incredibly self-compassionate kind of insight. And it reminded me, we've talked in the past about how sometimes people might choose self-blame, which leads to shame, as a way of maintaining also a belief that there's something that you can do to avoid or change the pain that you're experiencing. And I think that also plays a role in it. It's not just not wanting to view your parents as being bad, but it's also, well, maybe there is something that I can do. That self-blame and shame can be a part of the self, trying to take care of the self by believing that you have more control over a situation than you do. And I'm sure that goes on in adult relationships as well as childhood relationships.
It's easy to see how a person can get stuck in a shame and blame loop rather than admit that their caregivers were imperfect. In the next module, we'll look deeper into this kind of childhood shame that holds our clients back. I'll see you there.